From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 8. This week, Bob went into and broke down the connections between the two crime scenes in our case. We heard firearms analysis, as well as testimony from Willie Marshall. We heard the ins and outs of these connections, and Bob, Janet, and I are here to discuss and answer your questions and theories. And let me be the first to say, I'm happy that the three of us are back together finally.
Yeah, I feel like this season's been rough.
A minute.
To get all three of us together.
Yeah. It's been hit or miss. We're 8 weeks in, and I think this is our second episode where all of us are together.
Yeah. Second time. Well, it's a good week to have us all here. We don't have a whole lot of questions. So you guys know it was a shorter episode. I felt satisfied that I got the questions answered. And I saw from the questions that listeners were asking, people are not so much convinced. So I'm looking forward to talking about it. First things first, though, is what did you guys think? What were your big takeaways from the episode this week? Do you think there's a connection?
Well, clearly it sounds like there is a connection between the two scenes. You know, it's hard to say with the firearms analysis because we know now, it's a little more junk science than we like to believe or at the time they believed. But I mean, there's a lot of likelihood that it seems like these two scenes are connected. And especially with last week's episode that I was not here for the follow-up, knowing that Liz and Amp know each other, I mean, that's a huge connection as well.
Yeah, well, you dropped the junk science term, Zach, and we are going to be talking about that in a little bit because we definitely have a little pushback on that, perhaps rightly so. That is definitely still kind of a hot topic, I think, in testimony and analysis, in crime scene investigation, stuff like that. So I'll have a couple of listeners, certainly one way more well-versed than I, to talk about that. But, you know, for me, I'm just going to say it like it is for me, Bobby. For me, these episodes are tough because they're just feel. This is one where it really felt like there's just so much floating around it that we haven't gotten to yet. Mm-hmm. That I think I too was just kind of reluctant to accept the connection, even though I think it's very likely. I think it was more just like an overall reaction to like, well, I don't know, Willie. We haven't talked about this. I don't know what, you know, like now we're talking about stuff that was provably false in his testimony. Like, when do we decide what to take and what to throw away?
Right.
And I think other people maybe also felt that about the ballistics evidence. So I felt like still kind of conflicted about like, well, okay, give me more, you know?
Yeah. And I should be clear, like when I say like the scene, there's enough there for me to say, okay, they're probably connected. We should probably be looking at these as one crime scene that the two are connected. And the main reason for that, sorry, I guess I maybe should have made more clear in the episode, is there's no evidence to the contrary, right? So there's like this overwhelming amount of evidence that points to it. But the problem is, as you noted, the evidence that points to them being connected is like, none of it is like really solid, but it's like, there's a lot of it, right? So you know, we have Tasha telling us that, yeah, Liz and Amp were great friends. We have, you're going to hear this week, Larry mentions Liz being there. But again, with Larry, as you'll definitely hear from this episode, that's hard to know or believe if that's true. And then we got Willie saying that he heard in the background somebody's, you know, them saying something about Liz. And it's like, well, that seems pretty obvious. But then, you know, Willie says other things in there that we know is not true. So is the whole thing made up? Did he make up everything? I don't know. And then the firearms analysis, the tool mark analysis. I think a big part of it is, and I don't regret doing it because that's just, I felt like I had to put that part in there about how the different studies that have been put out about tool mark analysis, because I know first there's going to be a bunch of people that are going to say, yeah, but tool mark analysis can be junk science. And I know we have pushback on that, and I'm not here to argue against it. I don't know. I'm just going by what I, you know, the studies and things that I've read about it. So I just wanted, it wasn't that I wasn't putting that information out there to say, and this is why I don't believe it. It was just, I want you to have the full picture.
Right.
This is the analysis we have to work with. this is where the, you know, this is how courts have ruled about that type of evidence. And this is kind of some of the studies and how some people see it, just so you have that balanced. But at the end of the day, it was like any one of those things for me would not be enough. Even like maybe two of those things would not be enough for me to be like, yeah, they're connected. But it's like, man, it's just like everything starts piling on one after another, after another, after another. And then I start looking at, well, what evidence do we have to indicate that they weren't connected to counter any of that? And I just don't see any is kind of where I landed with it.
Well, what's really interesting about that is one of the connections that you've made that we've made in this case so far is the Liz and Amp connection. But that was never made by police.
Right. Yeah, exactly right.
So they talked to Tasha and Tasha informed you of that. But that was never, I mean, that's an interesting connection for us. And that's going to be great for our investigation. But as far as the original investigation, that wasn't there. That wasn't a piece in their puzzle.
Yeah. So then you kind of end up in that. I always talk about like in the West Memphis 3 case, the same type of thing. Like, what are the, for the people that still believe that Damien, Jason and Jesse are guilty, right? So what are the odds that the police pull this name out of a hat and go right after Damien Echols, and they just put all their effort into Damien, and then they build a case on him based on all this evidence. And then over the years, we figure out that literally everything they use to as evidence to point towards him is false, incorrect. It's not true. And then they're like, but he's still guilty. I'm like, so what are the odds they just randomly picked somebody and said it was him with no evidence? And then years later, they found evidence that made you still think that it was them. You know, I don't know if I'm articulating that right, but that's kind of how I feel about this. Like what Zach just said is, it's like, yeah, the police didn't even ask enough questions to know if Liz knew Amp, right? They never even questioned Tasha to find out any information about that. They just, we don't know. Willie passed away shortly after this, within a few years after this. I think it was like 2006 he passed away. So obviously he's not around to talk anymore. But Larry, you know, did later give a deposition that you're going to hear on Sunday. And, you know, we find out that, you know, spoiler alert, they fed him everything that he said. So then it's like, well, how do I believe any of it?
Yeah.
How do you, you know, so yeah, I get it. I totally get it. But then it's like, like I said, it's at the same time. It's like, I don't have any evidence to say that tool mark analysis is incorrect. I don't have enough to look at or even enough data to show to an expert, because they didn't present any of it for an expert to say that it was incorrect. So it's like, I just take his word for it. I don't know. Yeah, it's a tough one. The whole case is like that.
So I do have a question that I came up with listening to the episode. It may be a listener question. I don't have the questions for me to know. In the episode, you stated that Chris was not driving around with Liz. And you stated that pretty firmly in the episode. What is your reasoning behind that?
So when we get into Chris, we'll get into all those details. But like there's a whole bunch of witnesses that know where Chris was at.
Okay. Detail that I don't know right now.
Right.
It's a detail as a listener that we don't know. You know that and you can say that. But from my point of view, you just said it and I have no idea why.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was one of those where I tried, you know, it's always tricky for me when it's like, I just want you to know that part I know is not true. It's the same thing as the studies about tool mark analysis. It's like, I want you to have the full picture as much as I can give you right now in the fact that, and the funny thing is, the state's case is kind of against Chris is built around that other location where he was all night not driving around with Liz.
Okay.
Huh. Yeah, the case against him is built around that.
Yeah. But then we have this, like I said, the testimony doesn't make sense. That I'm telling you right now, the reason Chris got convicted, I don't even think it's so much because of his confession. Obviously, that's hard to get around. But once you hear it, you'll realize, you know, why it's real hard to believe. But really, I think it's because of Larry's testimony. Larry was so direct that it was, I went through some of his testimony a few episodes ago. So direct, I'm so sure that it was Chris Bynum that did this. That's what hung Chris Bynum. That is the thing that got him convicted, in my opinion, after reading the transcripts.
Which, and again, without knowing any of this, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more as soon as a week from now, that's the kind of thing that you just hear. And it seems like on any given day, you might think like, oh my God, that's so crazy that you could just get fed stuff and you would just say it and then you would put an innocent person in prison. But then imagine being a child who's gone through this horrible, horrible trauma. And when the cops tell you, hey, buddy, we've got the right guy. We just really need you. We need you to be like our deputy on this one. Like, are you gonna be our deputy? Yeah. Are you gonna help us out here? Like, you're gonna tell him. I mean, I'm not saying that's what happened, but you could see a scenario where in many different cases, people are like, well, I want to help put this person. They seem so sure it's him. Like, what's it going to hurt for me to just like back him up a little bit, whether or not I know it to be true?
Yeah. And you don't even have to like go too deep into the logic to take a step back and know that Larry Brooks is not to blame for any of this. He was in the fifth grade. He was a 12-year-old being manipulated by adults.
Yeah.
Adults in authority. So. But I don't want to get too much in that because that's what Sunday's whole episode is about.
Okay.
And I know we've got some very specific questions about this one. So let's go ahead and get into those.
Well, let's talk about the firearms analysis trick. I just want to, Donna posted this on the Facebook, and I just want to throw it out there. Speaking as a firearms examiner, Bob is incorrect in saying we are usually very limited in our testimony, and we are not bordering on junk science. There are bad labs and examiners, and there are good labs and examiners. If you find yourself on a jury with firearms examiner testimony, please evaluate it without that bias of junk science in your mind. We actually have a very low error rate. And then she provided a recent black box study. And it's open access. So that is on this week's follow-up post. So just look for this episode title. And I know you haven't had a chance to see it yet because I think she posted it today a couple hours before
the link,
we...
But yeah. But I'd be curious to know, and I appreciate that information, but I'd be curious because like I did read through quite a bit of like some of the studies I cited in other studies. And of course, it varies state by state. But it seemed to me that the part that is interesting to me is you said that they're not limited in what they're allowed to say. I wonder if that's a per state thing or by judge thing, because there's a lot of what they call in court, like a motion in limine, which is, you know, it happens before the trial comes up where, you know, usually it's something like the defense or the prosecutor knows the other side is going to present certain evidence and they have like a hearing before the judge and they're like, listen. I don't think here's all the reasons I don't want this to come out and have to object in front of the jury. So let's make some ground rules before we come out. And it seemed like there was a lot of those, like you see often would see those motions in limine where they say, okay, as far as the ballistics testing, like you cannot say that these match in front of the jury. You can, you know, you can say that they have that it was interesting because the study I was reading said that, you know, that a lot of the terminology that is often accepted is significant agreement
or sufficient agreement
and that was the exact terminology that we heard in the Delphi case. Yeah. And Donna is part of the, it was Donna, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Part of the reason that I have issues with this particular testimony is, as I said, we're talking about a whole bunch of bullets. You know, I've read through some of the firearms tool mark analysis from like the Delphi cases, the most recent ones kind of fresh in everybody's mind. And they were so detailed and so descriptive of, and they were putting up pictures of the different striations and marks that they used to compare the bullets. In this one, if you read the testimony, it's on our website. The entire testimony is 22 pages, which for trial testimony is not very much. And in that 22 pages is first, they always, you know, list your CV, tell us all your qualifications, your education, da, 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 da. Now tell us how you go about examining these types of projectiles. And they do it like this, like all like hypothetical. I mean, you're over halfway through the testimony of only 22 pages before they get into the actual bullets in question. And then it's just like real. And those last 10 pages that are left or 9 pages that are left of testimony, half that's cross-examination. So it's like 4 pages worth of them actually breaking down Henry Hatch actually breaking down the different bullets and projectiles. And he just says, I was able to match them or whatever terminology he used based on, you know, individual characteristics. And then it's like, okay, well, which one's matched? And he's like, this one, this one, this one, this one, and this one. Got it. Moved on. That's it. Like there was no like description of, see this striation here, that this is a very unique tool mark that would come from a specific gun, and see on this projectile, we have that same type of that same striation. See how I compare them. And here's a picture of how they're the evidence that they put in as exhibits instead of being photos like that, which for, at least in my experience, typically see when I'm going through tool mark analysis, testimony and the exhibits are like photos from under a microscope. In this case, the exhibits they put in were boxes with the actual bullets in them. So just like, it's this one, this is exhibit 112, this one, exhibit 113. And then there was the weirdness too about like, I think it was, I want to say it was exhibit 112 or exhibit 113, where when Bertozzi testifies, he's like, yeah, this was a piece of lead that we found on the floor, states exhibit 113. And then when Henry Hatch testifies, it's like, states exhibit 113 is a projectile that we found inside of Suzanne Wallace's head at the coroner's office, and it has striations on it that match. I was like, what? I don't know if they just, maybe it's a transcription error with the number or whatever, but I was like cross-referencing and making all these charts in my notes, trying to figure all this stuff out. And it was like, what do you mean? They came from two different places, according to them. But anyway, as far, I appreciate like someone who actually works in the field and testifies like this. And Donna, you know, go ahead, like I'll get on that Facebook post this week too. And look at, so we can communicate about this a little bit back and forth. Cause I'm curious, like what state you're in and if it's different state by state. Because kind of what she's describing is, I have no doubt that good tool mark examiner, it's the same thing as me when I was an arson investigator. A lot of people say arson investigation is junk science. And I would always argue the science of arson investigation is not junk science. It becomes junk science. And this is what you guys, longtime listeners, have heard me say this on the show before, is when the investigator makes claims saying they can prove something that is actually beyond what they can prove, right? So I can use burn patterns and all these different demarcation lines and all these different things and tell you, okay, it appears the point of origin of this fire was in this place. This is the heat source near there. When they start saying, I can tell from this that it was Billy that lit the fire, you know, like when they take it farther than the evidence actually allows them, that's what has made arson investigation look like junk science, from people claiming that they can tell you something that they can't actually tell you. So I always assume when I see things like this, it's probably very similar situation with like tool mark analysis, to where like the science involved for a good examiner is legit. It's when those same examiners then take it two steps further than they should, and then it loses its credibility.
I think that's a really good distinction to make and a really fair point. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because just like you, like Donna's saying, there are good and bad labs, there are good and bad examiners. Anytime you put a form of science into a human being's hands and put it in a circumstance where there may be pressure, there may be incentives, anything like that, there's a lot that you can abuse that will then give a bad name to people who are doing an honest day's work, who care about their field of study, and are there to show up and support the actual evidence in wherever it leads, you know?
Yeah, and this is kind of like par for the course in this case, too. And that's why I kind of prefaced it in the episode with this, is you see this through all the testimonies that I've posted so far. If you actually go to our website and read the testimonies, you'll see they're all so very short. And so it's like maybe Henry Hatch could have presented those photos and could have dug deeper and could have given a better explanation. But the prosecutors seem to always very intentionally move. It was like they don't want the impression I got was they don't want to overwhelm the jury with looking at details. So instead of like really digging into it, they're just like, how many of them match? Eight? Which eight? Cool. Next, let's move on. Like, I don't want to get into anything that's going to open up doors for the defense and cross-examination, because they have to stay within a certain scope of what happened in direct. So it's like they avoid anything that could lead them down a bad path and only ask the questions that are helpful to their case without digging into any real details.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that you hear about when we listen to like attorneys that we respect and stuff talking about it, which is that that could be for any number of reasons. An honest reason for that could be like, we're so afraid that the jury is going to get lost in the weeds of this and not get the point that, you know, we're trying to keep it like streamlined, to we don't trust the jury, they're, you know, we don't believe that they're smart enough to get this, to, you know, just any number of reasons why you do that aren't necessarily nefarious, because it is that chess game of being like, well, if we have this cell phone expert testify for 4 days, the jury is just going to fall asleep and we're afraid that they won't understand how important that evidence was. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. And there's perfectly legitimate trial strategies in any trial where an attorney would like in this case is probably a good example of it. Right. So you have a confession and you have an eyewitness from the scene testifying that they 100% know that it was the defendant. And if it's like, I want all of the jury's attention on that. I don't want to do anything to distract them from that evidence, because that's our ace in the hole right there. And that's, you know, not looking at it from some like crooked or nefarious reason, just like that's a legit strategy. You know, we see that sometimes on the defense in some of the cases we look at where it's like, you know, the defense sees they didn't prove this. I don't want to open up a whole bunch of doors and confuse the jury. Like, let's just make a real quick defense and just get out of here and get the acquittal.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Well, I want to just echo, it's basically what you said, Zach, but just want to echo what you said via Allison, who said that she also was like confused about the sort of where does it all fit together and does it fit together and does it really move the needle? But that connection between Amp and Liz felt like the kind of beacon that felt more important even than the weapons kind of conversation. But then Allison goes on to say, yes, they're closely connected. However, they were both in the drug world, which independently raised their risk. So I think we've covered the question, Allison, about which part of the gun evidence you feel confident in. But do you want to touch on that again, get a little more specific? Because that was also something that Colin had asked about, was just a little more clarification on like how many shots were fired, how many casings and bullets were recovered, and like where the expert witnesses weighed in. Just a little more clarification on that.
Yeah, I mean, it gets confusing because we have some reports and stuff that we're starting to get into now where, you know, we see like, oh, they recovered 3 bullets. But then you get into like Bertozzi's testimony. And it's like, well, there's, you know, he breaks it down in much more detail where it's like, there's a piece of a copper jacket. There's a chunk of lead. There's another chunk of lead. There's another. And it's like, what's a bullet and what's not? And then when you have a bullet that breaks apart like that and you have, you know, chunks of lead, it's like, well, could 4 of those chunks of lead have all come from the same bullet? Is that part of one bullet? So it's confusing. So the best that I've, after weeks of, in hours and hours and hours, that when I did the crime scene episode or the autopsy episode where I really got into the trajectories and the number of bullets and all that stuff at the house, you know, I spent a lot of time just trying to like go back to crime scene photos, to the exhibits that were presented at trial, to Pertosi's written report, to his testimony, and what I came up with was that there was 8 total bullets at the house, right? And we have 9 total injuries, and that's why we landed on the idea that one of them passed through Amp's arm into his neck. And of those, according to Hatch, the firearms examiner, I think there was 6 of those that were all, that he said all had individual, they all had the same like class characteristics, which those were like, it has 5 lands and grooves and a right hand twist. So that basically, and they kind of made it seem, now in cross examination, he was asked, so couldn't that have been another firearm, like any firearm of that class? And he agreed that, yeah, it could have been another firearm. But essentially, what I looked at as far as 5 lands and grooves, right hand twist, that was originally like a Smith & Wesson specific thing. And then many other firearms companies started making 38 calibers with that exact same setup. So any of those could have come from anywhere. But he said, without really going into detail, never went into any detail about what it was about those 6 bullets that told him that they came from the same specific gun. But he says 6 of those, and then 1 of the bullets from the crime scene at the ballpark. And that was one that I hadn't really mentioned, because we weren't really getting into like tracing how many bullets and things from the ballpark. But there was 1 bullet recovered from that scene that was just like laying in the snow. And we have like, but again, just like everything else, we have 1 crime scene photo. You see it laying in the snow. There's blood around it. And there's like a jean jacket next to it. But I don't know where it is. And all it's described of in the report is it's near the jean jacket. And I have a picture of the jean jacket.
Wild.
And I have a picture of the victims, but there's not 1 single picture that we have in evidence that has a shot where you can see the victims and the jean jacket to know where it's at.
That's weird. I can tell
because there's snow and I can see a chunk of concrete in the background that it's somewhere near where the victims are at, but I don't know exactly where, which would be super helpful, right? Because that would have to be the shot that went through Liz's head, because that one went through and through. It has an exit wound in the back, but it could tell us what direction they were coming from, you know? So anyway, I guess that's a lot of rambling, but to kind of answer the question, there's none of the evidence that I saw that I was super confident in as far as those forensics. But, you know, like I said, kind of at the start of the show, this expert got on the stand and said that he examined all them and found individual characteristics. That found that 6 of the bullets found at the house crime scene and 1 of the bullets found at the ballpark crime scene all came back to the same gun. So that obviously all it takes is 1 of those. Then there was the one that was Suzanne's head. So I think it was just the 1 from the ball field. And then there was 2 that didn't have, basically said he didn't have enough tool. There weren't enough individual markings for him to determine one way or the other. So essentially, according to him, that there was unique characteristics on a bullet from that ball field that had the same unique characteristics as the bullets from the house. And without any evidence to the contrary, if we accept that, it's hard not to say the two are connected. Then, like I said, when you start piling on everything else, and you pile on, you know, Liz tells us that, or Latasha tells us Liz and Amp were good friends. And then we have Willie saying that he heard Suzanne cussing about Liz in the background being there that same night. And, you know, so there's a lot of weak evidence, but it's kind of like there's so much of it. It's hard. I feel like it would be conspiratorial of me to be like, I still don't believe it because I don't have any evidence to not believe it.
Other than that, there are other things in the statements that are provably false, which is what I was struggling with.
Well, when I say believe it, I mean, I don't have any evidence to show you. I can't point to any one thing and say, see, because of this.
Right, right. That makes sense.
I don't think these 2 crime scenes are connected.
Correct.
I have nothing to do that with.
That's
fair. Yeah, but when you start taking in the totality of all the evidence, I think that's where it starts to line up, in my opinion.
Right.
Yeah, it's to the point where if it didn't, then we're dealing with a pretty, you know, pretty wild conspiracy at this point. Which I think there was a pretty wild conspiracy in this case. Don't get me wrong, but it's like they would have manipulated Larry and manipulated Willie, and then also manipulated the firearms examiner. And oh, by the way, it just so happens that they really were friends and they hung out all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
you know.
We don't have to stay on this for very much longer, but I guess because I didn't read I haven't read the firearms examiner's testimony. I think we talked about this during the Avery trial. Like, when someone can say in cross-examination, but could you rule out every other gun? And, or like, could you rule out X amount of guns, or could you rule out this other person's gun or this and this person's gun? And the person has to honestly say no. Then I'm like, I mean, and all due respect, and I probably just don't understand this, and I'm not being facetious. It's true. I'm like, then what are we doing here? Like, I don't know. Like, what's the right amount of, like, okay, every time, and there isn't an answer to this, I'm sure, but like, and where would you stop? But like, every time someone's analyzing a gun and a bullet, should they be given 20 guns and not know which one was found at the crime scene and have to analyze every single gun against that one bullet so that they can say, hey, I looked at 20 or 50 or 100 or 2 or whatever guns to make sure that that was a unique striation enough that we could say reasonable. I don't know what the comparison is, like, of the, like, what's the field of comparison outside of this, like, I gave you one thing, and you said they matched. Help me.
Right. And in this case, it's even harder to hang. Well, in this case, it's even harder to hang your hat on it because there is no other thing. Right. So there's thing one is, are the two crime scenes connected? All these bullets came from the same gun. But then there's the other piece of that, which was what usually really matters, is what gun did they come from and who used it?
Right.
In this case, there is no gun.
Oof.
There's no gun to compare it to. So it's only, and maybe that's part of why they didn't really spend much time on it. It was just like, we're just using this to establish that the two crime scenes were connected. Boom, 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 and we're out of here. But yeah, there's no like other gun. There's not like in Stephen Avery's case where they're like, we can take Chris Bynum's gun and fire a test round and compare it to these striations and see if it was his gun. Like, that doesn't exist. He didn't have a gun. Like, there was no gun to compare it to. It just makes it feel more squishy, even, because it's like,
yeah, it's like missing data points. It's like, how many dots are you connecting? It's like the dots now are so far apart. You could almost, if you're looking at a constellation of stars and you have 10 stars, one person's going to be like, look, a scorpion. And the other person's going to be like, look, a file cabinet or whatever. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's because the dots are real far apart. And you're just drawing lines every which way.
Yeah, it'd be nice if you're able to do like what you can do with DNA, because with DNA, you really don't hear testimony anymore that would say like, this DNA is a match to this defendant. It is his to the exclusion of all others. But they are able to use statistics. They can say this DNA is the same as the same DNA profile as the defendant, and the odds of someone having this same profile are 1 in 240 trillion.
Yeah.
Like, so you can say, and then you can do the, you know, it's his, right? Without saying it's his.
Yeah.
But I don't think with like firearms analysis, like that statistic exists, because that's kind of what I was reading in some of those studies was like they're I'm trying to think of the term they use, but it was like, you couldn't quantify the margin of error.
Hmm.
I think it was, and I may be getting that wrong. And if I did, Donna's probably screaming right now. Sorry. But essentially that was it. It was just like, there's not like, when you see, okay, well, this striation I think is the same as this one. Like, well, how many, you know, one in how many bullets could have that same marking? There's just no way to quantify that like there is in DNA.
Got it. Let's turn to, and you may not have answers for this quite yet, but let's turn to the conversation back to Willie and Larry, or just the idea of the testimony where the name Chris is thrown around. First of all, Allison, different Allison from the other one, wants to know, is there an interview with Willie at the time of the murders? If so, does it give a different, does it give different information than the testimony at trial?
Yeah, I thought, maybe I'm wrong, maybe my brain's not working right, but I thought that I talked about his original statement and the differences in his original statement through his trial testimony. Did I not bring that up in the episode?
I think you did, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so his original statement is up on should be up on our website. Yeah, there's a difference, like the one big difference, the only difference that the defense attorney came up on, you know, that attacked during cross was that at trial he said, Chris came by the house earlier that day with Liz, or he saw them earlier that day and they said they were threatening him. And that's when I was like, well, I know that like that's not true. It's not possible, or whatever he said, because the timing just didn't work out. But then on cross-examination, they pointed to his original statement and said, here, you said several days ago you saw him. And now you're at trial testifying that it was that day. And Willie, of course, just goes, I mean, he just blew it off. He just didn't really answer the question. Willie's, I don't really pin down on it in the episode you're going to hear on Sunday, but it would be worth, if for those of you that are like the super sleuths that really like to get into the weeds and all this, when you hear Sunday's episode and you get the Larry Brooks's first statement and you have Willie's statement taken the same day by the same cop, and you compare them to me, and I'm going to address this later, but to me, I see a pattern of how things get kind of brought into it. It'd be worth the price of admission to read those two and kind of do your own analysis on it. And we'll be talking about that stuff later.
Okay, cool. Interesting. Patricia says, during their phone call, did Amp identify Chris by first and last names to Willie? Chris or Christopher is a fairly common name, so without a last name, it doesn't identify an exact person. The note with the phone number at Michelle's on, Michelle said, Chris, I wonder if Amp and Liz both had the same drug dealer named Chris. After Sunday's episode, I'm more convinced that the two murder sites are linked.
Yeah, like I said, I think they're probably linked. But the point she's making there about Chris, the further and further I dig into this, the problem is it's hard to know what to believe, right? So like, it's hard to know, was there really a note that said Chris on it? I think there was. So if there was a note that said Chris, and if did Larry, I think I saw some people are like, why are you just cherry picking certain things? I'm not doing that. I'm just trying to look at like the things that seem believable to me. But then there's other parts of these statements that like I know are impossible. So it's like, do you throw the baby out with the bathwater? Do you, you know, like what I had said with as far as Willie's statement, something about him just throwing in there. Yeah, I heard Suzanne in the background saying, you know, if that bitch comes back here, whatever, I'm going to kick her ass. I was like, that seemed like an odd thing to throw in, you know, because it doesn't help them. If the police are like giving him information and telling him what to say, that doesn't help the case against Chris at all, right? The fact that Liz was there, unless it's, I guess it kind of like connects the two, but, and I'm not even saying that I definitely believe that, but it just jumped out at me. Gosh, I just lost it. Where did I start with this? I just lost my train of thought completely.
Just the first and last kind of the idea of Chris being a common name.
Yeah. That's where I was going with it is, if you have the note and if you have, and I will say this, after reading Chris or Larry's 2020 deposition transcript, when he's an adult now and he's telling everybody what happened, after reading his transcript, I think there was someone named Chris that was involved with this. I think that's the only link to Chris Bynum. But what is becoming more and more and more clear to me, at least the way I'm seeing it right now, is that there was a Chris that Amp knew that used to come by. There was a Chris that was there and was involved in this, but it wasn't Chris Bynum. It was a different Chris. And like you said, like that's not an uncommon name at all. It's not even Chris's name. I mean, it's his middle name. His name is actually Cleveland. It's Cleveland Chris Bynum, but he goes by Chris. So yeah, I think there probably is a Chris involved. I just don't think it's our Chris.
Which, by the way, is also, I'm sad to say, I mean, I'm sure like all of this, however rare or not rare you want to think of wrongful convictions as being, I feel like without being able to name it off the top of my head, like I know there was at least one undisclosed season or case where it was a matter of so-and-so dropped the name, first name, blah, blah, blah. And like, mm-hmm. That's a person who had that same first name ended up getting convicted. Like that is something that happens.
Yeah.
Probably more often than we would like is like, okay, someone mentioned the name Bob. We got a Bob over here. We asked him some stuff. Yeah. He started to look suspicious. Next thing you know, we confess we got him.
Yeah. And that's like, I'm not saying this is what happened. I'm nowhere near far enough into it to like make this kind of determination. But the thing that I've been wondering about over this last week when I've been really digging through all the, especially going through all Larry's statements, is was it that simple? Was it that simple that they got the name Chris and they're like, well, here's this other Chris that was on there because I don't want to give too much away, but there, you know, there, there's a way they stumbled upon Chris Bynum, and they're like, Chris, here's a Chris. And they're like, well, let's just get this guy. Oof. And it was that simple.
Oh, that's not something to look forward to.
It's horrific. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty much it. I think we've addressed everything else in one way or another. But for those of you who left your comments, we got to almost all of you. Thank you for weighing in and helping us with this discussion. It's like I said at the beginning of this episode, give me more.
Yeah.
I wish I had more to build off of all this stuff.
That's how I felt when I was going through the testimony. So I was like, okay, this is going to be the week. Okay, we've got all this information. Because it was like Zach said, when Tasha told me, oh yeah, she knew Amp. They were great friends. I knew Amp. And it was like, oh, holy shit. Okay. So there is a connection. And that's why I wanted to like, well, now I'm going to move over and dig into this. And I'm like, I'm going to pull the fire examiner stuff. I'm going to go through all these pictures. I'm going to go through the testimony and the reports. And we're just going to really figure this thing out. It was like 22. That's what you're giving me? Like, what do you mean? That's all there is to it. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Which again, that was, you know, that was one of those rare occasions where like I finish writing everything I have. And I'm like, well, we're 8 pages. And now what? What are we going to talk about now? I guess that's going to be it. Yeah. And also just kind of to update you guys too, I'd mentioned, so I still have not been able to connect with Amp's son. We have texted back and forth a couple times, but there's been a couple different occasions where like this past Friday, he said he was going to call me Friday and I never got the call. And in these situations, I just don't ever want to put, you know, with a family member of a victim, I don't want to push. So I just make sure I'm making myself available to him. And so I'm confident. And so I hope that conversation will happen. And as I said before, as I promised Tasha and make the same promise to Amp Jr. and any other family members as we move along. If they say they're ready to come on and do an interview and let you guys hear their story and their family member's story, then it's all things halt. And we will do that interview and we will get it out there. Because I think that's one of the most important parts of this case is to make sure that we do not lose track of these victims and their voices and their stories. And with that being said, guys, I thank so much for listening and being a part of this. There's some great conversation, great questions. Hopefully Donna's not yelling at me on Facebook now as we speak, but we'll find out as the week goes on. So thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Make sure you tune in on Sunday. I'm real excited for you guys to hear the Larry Brooks episode that's coming out in 2 days. So, and then we'll talk to you guys next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kate Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.